Last week, we read chapter 9. That's where we got to. But we didn't make a lot of comments about it, so I don't want to reread the chapter, but I want us to start there because I think chapter 9 is a very important chapter. Come in. I appreciate this, but nobody can figure out how to get it to go down a little bit.
Oh, you want me to go get you a lower one?
Well, if we have one, don't do it today.
Okay. I'll check after class.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you can sit
back. Well, it's not. I like it when I get up on it, but I'm afraid I'm gonna break my neck getting up. And
what?
Did you try the little bar underneath when you sit on it?
We tried everything. We pulled it and pushed it and twisted it. And
okay.
Don't worry about it, Laura. We'll get by today without it.
We don't want to have any unforeseen accidents.
Do what?
We don't want any unforeseen accidents.
I think chapter 9 has got some. It's kind of a milestone. There's several important things that happen in 9, and I want to emphasize those before we get to chapter 10. This is Job's reply to Bildad, the second of his three friends. He starts out, he says it's real foolish to debate or to get in a dispute with God. I mean, he says God's got all the advantages, you know. He's all-knowing, he's all-powerful. So in verses 2 through 4, he says it's kind of futile to get into a debate with God or a dispute. But that's what he wants to do. He wants to. His suffering is so bad that he's really willing to take chances, you know. In 14 through 17, he says, even if he could dispute with God, God would crush him. God is so terrifying a thought to contend with God Almighty, you know, that he just doesn't want to do it. In verse 22 through 24 of that chapter, he says, it's all the same. That's why I say, God destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When a scourge comes, brings sudden death, he mocks the despair of the innocent. When the land falls into the hands of the wicked, he blindfolds its judges. If it's not he, then who is it? So Job's friends have been telling him, God protects and rewards the innocent. God punishes and destroys the wicked. And here Job has been complaining, why are you punishing me without cause? I don't deserve what's happening. But suddenly he's broadening the scope of his complaint to God here. You know, his complaint is not me personally, but you seem to allow everybody, the wicked and the innocent, to suffer when bad times come. So he's redefining or broadening his complaint to God. He wants to contend with God about suffering in the world, okay?
And question about verse 24, the last phrase there. If it is not he, then who is it?
Yeah.
He's saying it's God, right?
It's God. If it's not God, who is it? There's nobody else. That's his point. He never blames Satan or anybody else. Everything is happening, good and bad, to him, he attributes to God. And I think we can learn from that. I'm going to have a whole lot to say about next week about Job's complaint. And to me, next week is the climax of this class, okay? It's something that I thought through in 1977 and presented at a Bible study, and I want, if you miss anything, don't miss next week, okay? Because that, to me, I enjoy teaching that class more than any others. But Job has concluded that in this world, God doesn't always reward the innocent, and he doesn't always punish the wicked. So he sees God, if God is justice, at least his world, his creation, is amoral. He doesn't see anything that would indicate to him that God actively protects the innocent and actively punishes the wicked. He's going to lament the fact that the wicked go get by with everything, and God just kind of winks at them. Okay? He's going to use that terminology. So, he's broadened his complaint. And of course, that's got to be blasphemous to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, because they have continually said, Job, you're suffering because you've sinned. If you don't want to suffer, quit sinning. And they'll tell Job, these are all the good things that will happen to you if you quit sinning. Or they will say, here's all the bad things that will happen to you if you keep on sinning. And that's the entirety of their argument. They present that over and over and over, 8 times to Job. Never change. That's not debatable to them. They're sticking by that theology. And I have a lot to say about that next week. Verse 32 through 35, he says, God, he's talking about God, he's not a man like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hand upon us, both. Someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more. Then I would speak up without fear of him. But as it now stands with me, I cannot.
He speaks so pretty good now.
He is, but he's talking to, I think, his friends, you know, but we're going to see. That's another thing I'll talk about in a minute. But,
where was that you just read?
That's the end of chapter 9.
Thank you. I'm way behind.
He longs for an arbitrator, somebody that will arbitrate between him and God, because he's got a complaint to God. He wants to defend himself to God, but he's terrified of the prospect. And of course, we know who our arbitrator is, don't we? You know, Job doesn't have the gospel. He doesn't have the New Testament. But we know that we have an arbitrator in Jesus, right? So, but you got to remember the setting. This is ancient, ancient, maybe before the law of Moses. I don't know. But, well, you know, it's a contemporary with Abraham. So, notice that in this chapter, Job begins to wish for a trial with God. Okay? He begins to prepare his case. Prior to this, he's just complained. You know, he said, God, why me? I want to die. Let me die, God. Why are you doing this to me? But now he's thinking that he can prepare a case to God. Verse 3, he says, though one wished to dispute with him, he couldn't answer him one time out of 1,000. Verse 14, how can I dispute with him? How can I find words to argue with him? Though I were innocent, I could not answer him. I could only plead with my judge for mercy. Even if I summoned him and he responded, I don't believe he would give me a hearing. This is a lot of legal terminology. He wants to summon God. He wants a hearing with God. God is his judge. He knows that even if he's innocent, he doesn't think he's capable of defending himself to God. But you see that terminology begin to, he's going to develop this idea more and more in the chapters that are coming up here. So, and you see that also in 32. He says, he's not a man like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. That's what he wants, is a confrontation, a court hearing with God, okay? So,
He
would like to hear God's defense for what's happening to him, and he would like to accuse God, actually. He wants to accuse God of ignoring the suffering of the innocent and ignoring the punishment of the wicked, both ways, okay? In verse 29, he says, since I'm already found guilty, why should I struggle in vain? So the verdict, he knows, if he confronts God, is he's going to be guilty. But he doesn't know why. And he's willing to confront God because he's suffering so terribly. He's suffering at the, you know, his, he's reached the limit of human endurance, I think, with his suffering. 32 again, he says he would like for there to be a confrontation between him and God in court. He mentions in court there. So, like I said, we're going to see Job talk about this trial that he's hoping for, that he's wishing for, more and more as we go into the debate. So let's pick up in chapter 10 now. Did I say that the key verse in this chapter is he destroys both the blameless and the wicked? I think that's, and you know, when you're reading Job, you're reading poetry. So you read along and you read a lot of poetry, and then Job says something and you read more poetry, and you miss it because it's poetry. But this is a key point right here. So to study Job, you've got to kind of take a microscopic look at one verse, what he says in one verse, to catch the essence of what he's saying. But then on the other hand, sometimes you have to back off and take a panoramic view, a summary of, well, what are his three friends saying, and what is Job saying? What is the overall thesis that they're arguing from? So it's hard to teach this because I want us to read it for the poetry, and I want us to catch these little jewels in these verses where Job reveals what he's thinking. But at the same, and I want us to get the panoramic view at the same time. So let's read chapter 10, and I'm hoping we can get to chapter 14 today. We'll see if we can. If I can get some readers 1 through 7.
I got it.
Okay.
I loathe my very life, therefore I will give free rein to my complaint and speak out in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me, but tell me what charges you have against me. Does it please you to oppress me, to spurn the work of your hands, while you smile on the schemes of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as a mortal sees? Are your days like those of a mortal? Are your years like those of a man? That you must search out my faults, and probe after my sin. Though you know that I am not guilty, and that no one can rescue me from your hand.
He mentions don't condemn me. What are the charges? This is all legal terminology. Court, you know, he wants the court. But these are the things that he would use in his defense, in his court case with God. You know, he would say, don't condemn me, just tell me what the charges are. Does it please you? He would reason with God to try to get God to take away the punishment that he thinks he has, because he thinks that God's already found him guilty over in chapter 9. So, somebody read this 8 through 17 for the class. Okay.
Your hand shaped me and made me. Will you now turn and destroy me? Remember that you molded me like clay. Will you now turn me to dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews? You gave me life and showed me kindness, and in your providence watched over my spirit. But this is what you concealed in your heart. I know that this was in your mind. If I sinned, you would be watching me and would not let my offense go unpunished. If I am guilty, woe to me. Even if I am innocent, I cannot lift my head, for I am full of shame and drowned in all my affliction. If I hold my head high, you stalk me like a lion and again display your awesome power against me. You bring new witness against me and increase witnesses against me and increase your anger against toward me. Your forces come against me, wave upon wave.
So he would appeal to God based on God's. He would reason with God, wouldn't he? You created me. You provided for me in your providence. Why now are you torturing me? Why now are you So he's appealing to God's reason and compassion, I think. He says something in verse 17 there. You bring new witnesses against me. Who do you reckon that is?
His friends.
Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They came to sympathize and comfort him, but they turned out to not sympathize at all. They condemned him. So they're witnesses against Job. I don't know that that's who the witnesses are, but he may be speaking totally figuratively, but Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are certainly good candidates for witnesses against Job, based on what they say.
He could even be referring to, well, that was the first wave of horribleness you brought in my life, and then you turned around and then brought more.
Yeah.
If this is all telling me I'm bad,
yeah,
you got a second group that came and told me I was even worse.
Right. And then Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar come along and say, you're really bad.
One after another.
Yeah. Somebody read the rest of the chapter, 18 through 22.
I can read it.
Okay.
Why then did you bring me out of the womb? I wish I had died before and I saw me. If only I had never come into being or had been carried straight from the womb to the grave. Are not my few days almost over? Turn away from me, so I can have a moment's joy before I go to the place of no return, to the land of gloom and deep shadow, to the land of the deepest night, of deep shadow and disorder, where even the light is like darkness.
Okay, so he returns to this desire to die, right? He wants God to go ahead and let him die. Why was I ever born? This is repeat from chapter 1. This is about the third or fourth time. And you're going to see this throughout the book. Job goes through this. He goes from this to this to this. He talks about, why was I ever born? I'm suffering. I want to die. God, why are you doing this to me? And then he will appeal to God. And then he'll turn and appeal to his friends. And they do the same thing. If you analyze their speeches, they will all, almost to a man, they say, Job, you're an idiot. You're a rebellious idiot against God, and you ought to just accept your suffering. Then they try to give him advice. Appeal to God, okay, and he'll remove the suffering. And then they say, here's what's going to happen to you if you would just return to God. And they list these things that's going to happen to him if he just returns to God. Or they say, here's the bad things that are going to happen to you if you don't repent and return to God. That's all they ever say. From Eliphaz's first speech to Bildad's last speech, all eight speeches, that's all they ever say to Job. And I think it's significant that they came to comfort him and sympathize with him, but they're incapable of doing it. And we're going to talk about that a lot next week, because they have a theology that will not allow them to comfort Job, okay? They have a theology that would say, I'm working against God if I try to. God's punishing you for reasoning. I'm not going to interfere with that. The only thing I can do is advise you to quit doing what God doesn't like that you're doing, okay? So that's all they can do. They're helpless to be a comforter. And Job points that out to them repeatedly, okay? So, any questions on chapter 10, in our comments? But he longs to God, please turn away from me and just let me die. His suffering is so intense.
Yeah, I want to tell something I've discovered that really has shocked me. When you start talking to people about, they'll say, how are you doing? And if you're not doing real well, and you start telling them, guess what they'll tell you? They don't even know you.
Yeah.
They've never eaten with you. They've never been anywhere. They'll say you're blessed.
Yeah.
And generally, we are all blessed. But when you're trying to share something bothering you, that's a good way to shut somebody up.
Yeah. And
there you go.
One of the things, I've got one of the later lessons here, there are a lot of practical lessons you can learn from Job, and one of them is, how not to comfort somebody that's suffering, because they're the world's worst, okay? So that's a real practical lesson. And if the people ask you how you're doing it, they don't really want to know.
And usually they're gone before you even start talking to them.
Yeah, yeah, that's a formality, not a sincere request.
Right. Okay.
I was just thinking there's lots of people in here who came to comfort Doyle. And I'm sure glad you weren't like those three guys.
Yeah.
I appreciate you.
Chapter 11, Zophar speaks. He's the third friend. And at the end of his speech, that will be the end of round one, or cycle one of the debate. Three times. Somebody read the chapter. It's not that long. It's one column in my scripture.
I can do it.
Okay.
Then Zophar the Naamathite replied, "Are all these words to go unanswered? Is this the talker to be vindicated? Will your idle talk reduce others to silence? Will no one rebuke you when you mock? You say to God, 'My beliefs are flawless and I am pure in your sight.' Oh, how I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom, for true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than the heavens above. What can you do? They are deeper than the depths below. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth, wider than the sea. If he comes along and confines you in prison and convenes a court, who can oppose him? Surely he recognizes deceivers, and when he sees evil, does he not take note? But the witless can no more become wise than a wild donkey's colt can be born human. Yet if you devote your heart to him and stretch out your hands to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand, and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then free of fault, you will lift up your face, and you will stand firm without fear. You will surely forget your trouble, recalling it only as waters gone by. Life will be brighter than noonday, and darkness will become like the morning. You will be secure, because there is hope. You will look about you and take your rest in safety. You will lie down with no one to make you afraid, and many will court your favor. But the eyes of the wicked will fail, and an escape will elude them. Their hope will be a dying gasp."
Okay, so do you see the pattern there? You're an idiot.
No,
you surely would lose in an argument with God. He mentions the court again. He says in verse 10, if he comes along and confines you in prison and convenes court, Job, you're going to lose. Who can oppose him? You're going to lose in a court case with God. And Job knows that, but Job's going to do it anyway, I think. But then he gives his advice in verse 13, devote your heart to God. Stretch out your hands to him. Put away the sin that's in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent. And then all these good things will for the rest of the chapter. Okay? All these blessings will be yours if you will just put away the sin in your life. No more suffering. He says, God's even forgotten some of your sins. You're so wicked that God's not even keeping total count on them, you know. You're just suffering for part of your sins. They get more and more vicious in their comforting of Job, you know. So, let's see where we are.
We're ready to start number.
This ends the first round or the first cycle. I want you to see this clearly, how Eliphaz speaks and then Bildad copies him and then Zophar copies Eliphaz. Eliphaz, I think, is probably the oldest. But if you look here in this chapter, if you put away sin, then you will lift up your face. You will stand firm without fear. You will surely forget your trouble. Life will be brighter than noonday. You will be secure because there's hope. Job has no hope right now. You will lie down and no one will make you afraid. Okay? Go back. If you look back at Eliphaz's speech when Job cursed the day of his birth, at the end of his speech, He says, you know, if you blessed is the man whom God corrects. He says, starting in 21, you will be protected from the lash of the tongue. You will laugh at destruction. You will have a covenant with stones. You will know that your tent is secure. You will take stock of your property and nothing missing. Job just lost everything he owns, right? You will know that your children will be many. He just lost 10 kids, you know? So they're really pouring it on Job. You know, they're really being cruel to him. But Bildad and Zophar just copy Eliphaz. Same arguments, you know? So, let me get Zophar out of the way here. I'd like to read 12 and 13. Just read it through, about four readers, a half a chapter apiece, and then come back and talk about it from in. So, give me four readers. I'd like to pick out four. One, two, three. One more? Okay, four.
Go ahead, Alan.
Read 1 to 12 of chapter 12, then 13 to 25.
Then Job replied, doubtless you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have a mind as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know all these things? I have become a laughing stock to my friends. Though I called upon God, and he answered, a mere laughing stock, though righteous and blameless. Men at ease have contempt for misfortune, as the fate of those whose feet are slipping. The tents of marauders are undisturbed, and those who provoke God are secure, those who carry their God in their hands. But ask the animals, and they will teach you, or the birds of the air, and they will tell you, or speak to the earth, and it will teach you, or let the fish of the sea inform you. Which of these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. Does not the ear test words as the tongue tastes food? Is not wisdom found among the aged? Does not long life bring understanding?
To God belong wisdom and power, counsel and understanding are his. What he tears down cannot be rebuilt. Those he imprisons cannot be released. If he holds back the waters, there is drought. If he lets them loose, they devastate the land. To him belongs strength and insight. Both deceived and deceiver are his. He leads rulers away, strips, and makes fools of judges. He takes off the shackles put on by kings and ties a loincloth around their waist. He leads the priest away, stripped, and overthrows the officials long established. He silences the lips of trusted advisors and takes away the discernment of elders. He pours contempt on nobles and disarms the mighty. He reveals the deep things of darkness and brings utter darkness into the light. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and disperses them. He deprives the leaders of earth of their reason. He makes them wander in a trackless place. They grope in darkness with no light. He makes them stagger like drunkards.
Okay. 13, 1 to 12. Who has 13? Was it you?
Behold, my eye hath seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewashed with lies, worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom. Hear now my argument, and listen to the pleading of my lips. Will you speak falsely for God, and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out? Or can you deceive him as one deceives a man? He will surely rebuke you if in secret you show partiality. Will not his majesty terrify you and the dread of him fall upon you? Your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay.
Keep silent and let me speak. Let me, then let come to me what may. Why do I put myself in jeopardy and take my life in my hands? Though he slay me, yet I will hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Indeed, this will turn out for my deliverance, for no godless person would dare come before him. Listen carefully to what I say. Let my words ring in your ears. Now that I have prepared my case, I know I will be vindicated. Can anyone bring charges against me? If so, I will be silent and die. Only grant me these two things, God, and then I will not hide from you. Withdraw your hand far from me and stop frightening me with your terrors. Then summon me and I will answer, or let me speak and you reply to me. How many wrongs and sins have I committed? Show me my offense and my sin. Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Do you torment a wind-blown leaf? Do you chase after dry chaff? For you write down bitter things against me and make me reap the sins of my youth. You fasten my feet in shackles and keep close watch on all my paths by putting marks on the soles of my feet. So okay. Man wastes away like something rotten, like a garment eaten by moths.
Okay, that's a description of his physical condition right there in verse 28. So, I love the sarcasm. You know, Job, as much as he's suffering, he still has a sense of humor, doesn't he? In verse 2, he says, let me find you. I'm out of place here. Verse 2. Doubtless you're the people and wisdom will die with you. That's sarcasm, right? And he comes back in sarcasm in 13. He says, if only you'd be altogether silent, for you, that would be wisdom. Okay? And Job uses sarcasm in his reply to them. When God speaks to Job in the end of the poem, he appears in a whirlwind and he says, he starts a litany of things that God has done that is beyond Job's comprehension. And he says, surely you know this. You were there. You know, you're so old. So God is being very sarcastic with Job at the end of the book. So there's a lot of sarcasm in here. And don't take it seriously. I mean, this is humor, okay?
And it's human.
Yeah, it's human. So, but then in verse 5, he says, many of these have contempt for misfortune, mm-hmm. as the fate of those whose feet are slipping. He's addressing that at Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. He's saying, you guys got it easy, and you're criticizing me because I'm suffering. And I think about it, that's so human. That's so human nature, you know. We see somebody suffering, and we say, what in the world did God do that to him for, you know?
What did they do wrong?
Yeah. There's an American Indian proverb that says, walk a mile in, don't criticize your, I've got a friend or something, until you've walked a mile in his shoes. Mm-hmm. Job is where they've never been, okay? And he's asking for understanding here. You know, y'all are being contemptuous of me and my suffering. So, I want to make these points because I think they enlighten us a little bit as to what the thing's about. 12 through 25 of chapter 12, 13 through 25, he just says basically God's in control of everything. God is the source of everything that happens. He deceives, he puts away the deceiver and the deceived. He does everything. He continues to build his case in 13 verse 3. I desire to speak to the Almighty, to argue my case with God. He insults his friends because they've been insulting him. He says in 13, will you speak wickedly on God's behalf? will you speak deceitfully for him? In other words, he says, if you're trying to defend God with bad, deceitful language here, okay? He says, surely God would rebuke you, you know, if he examined you. Verse 12, he says, your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. That's what Job thinks of their advice. Actually, Job can't take their advice. They keep telling him, return to God. And he says, I never left God. I don't know what's going on. I don't know why God's doing this to me. But he cannot take their advice. So their advice is useless, and that's what he keeps saying. Okay?
Well, I have a question. We all recognize that we sin, but Job didn't recognize that he transgressed.
Well, I think he would say he's a sinner. He knows he's a sinner. He doesn't think that what's happening to him is because of his sin. I think he says in several places, for example, let me find one here. He says, you make me inherit the sins of my youth.
Yeah.
You know, he says he sinned. He just doesn't believe that his suffering, as the intensity of his suffering, is a result of something he's done wrong. And I think that's the way he's holding on to his integrity, and I think he's right to do that.
I have a little struggle with that, because God doesn't want to do anything to us that's been justified.
Yeah.
In terms of sin. So anyway,
yeah, I struggle with a lot in Job, you know. But yeah, I think he would recognize that he's a sinner. In several places throughout the poem, he indicates that he's a sinner, but he doesn't believe that he's being punished justly. He says, you're doing this to me for no reason. And I think, as far as he can tell, he's right.
That's not commensurate with his sin, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And God even called him blameless or something like that.
As Christians, I've heard many Christians say, we all deserve death. And that's true. But God doesn't give us all death in this life. And that's part of the essence of Job, is his friends are saying, God will give justice right now. And Job says, well, he doesn't seem to be doing that in this life, you know. So I think that's part of the theme of the book. He admits in verse 13 through 15, that he's putting his life in, he's taking a real risk here, you know. He's, to speak out about God like he's doing is dangerous. But he doesn't have anybody else that can put hope in. I've heard this passage, though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. That's a statement of tremendous hope, but it's said in desperation. He says, I'm going to defend myself to God, and he's probably going to end my life, but I don't have anywhere else to put my hope. That's what he's saying. Verse 18, now that I've prepared my case, here's the court case again, okay? I know I will be vindicated. Then the essence is, he said, in 20 he tells God, grant me two things, God, because you're so terrifying to me. You know, grant me these two things in my trial. Then I will not hide from you. Withdraw your hand far from me and stop frightening me with your terrors. Then here's the trial. Then summon me and I will answer. Or let me speak and you reply. Okay? That's what Job wants from God. And he says, I want to defend myself. I'll be the defendant. I want to accuse you. I'll be the plaintiff. You take your pick. I'll summon you. You summon me or I'll summon you. Either way. And when at the end of the book, when God speaks, what does he say? It's let me go there. I find this interesting. And that's it there. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you answer me. So God says, here's the deal. I'm not going to be defending myself. I'm going to question you, and you answer. And God never does defend himself throughout the poem. And I think that's neat, you know. I like that. So, let's see where we are now.
You know, God is really sounds very arrogant right there.
God is arrogant.
Right, right, and that's in that passage.
Yeah, God is sovereign. He does what he wants to do.
Right. Assuming errors that you don't deserve, but being sovereign, you can take whatever you want to.
Yeah,
you deserve it.
We'll talk about that next week in the key class for the whole course, okay? Let's see.
We'll be there.
Do what?
We'll be there. I feel sorry for Job. I really do.
I do too. I identify with Job. I think that's one of the things when we're all puzzled about life and suffering. Why is suffering so bad? You know, and I think the Christian has an answer for that.
Well, those who suffer for doing good will be rewarded
at the end, but that's in another life.
Well, Job was rewarded here on earth.
I've got a little 12-minute video I want you to watch that says Job is restored, but not as a reward.
Well,
God in his sovereignty gives
well,
a gift.
Jesus was, you know.
Do what?
Jesus was, you know. He suffered for doing good.
And
we gained salvation, but
and I think we are rewarded for doing good. I just don't think we get. He makes no promises that there'll be in this life.
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. Jesus, well, he died on the cross. He didn't get rewarded for doing good in this life.
And
he got
a lot of
crucified.
People did, and that's for sure.
Yeah.
In the Bible.
So, yeah, and remember I said in an earlier class, we see things in the Bible and we think that's the way it is, but a lot of times those are the exceptions. You know, that's the exception rather than the rule of how God works in our lives.
I think it's interesting that throughout the whole thing, nobody ever blames Satan.
Right. He's not even addressed.
Yeah.
God did.
So,
at one point, God said, "You made me..."
Yeah, he did. That's right. He said, "You made me do this without cause." Mm-hmm. He said, "You incited me to do this."
Throughout our history, sovereignty, you know, kings, queens, they could do whatever they want, right or wrong. Yeah. They could pardon, they could give, they could have you killed.
Yeah, that's one of the problems we have.
That's sovereignty.
That's sovereignty, yes. And this country was founded on getting away from a sovereign king, right?
Mm-hmm.
You look at our history. So we don't identify with... I think our culture has driven us to where every individual is sovereign.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Rather than being subject to a king. We don't understand this king concept at all, you know? So anyway, that's
all. There was a time when it was... We understood the submission to God as king, to Jesus as king. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a culture, we understood that.
Yeah.
And now our individualism is trying to trump that.
Yeah.
And produce what you said.
Yeah. Okay.
Just a wondering about the whole book and I guess about the poetry and the Old Testament in general. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the poetry, you've got the sarcasm, and I think we have to be careful that we don't take, like, individual verses and take them literally.
Right.
For example, 12 verse 20, talking about God, he deprives of speech those who are trusted and takes away the discernment of the elders. You know, you have to take it in context. You don't say, oh, this is a truth that we...
God doesn't always do
that. Yeah, we have to depend on that truth because it says it in the Bible and it's inspired.
Yeah.
So I have learned in Job to be careful with both his friends, quote unquote, and Job himself to not take things literally like we do maybe in other scriptures.
Yeah, like this is an absolute law that God does this.
Right.
God, I would say what he's saying is when elders lose their discernment, God does it. That's what Job is saying.
That's that general principle.
Yeah.
that further down there in verse 24. He deprives leaders of the earth of their reason. He sends them wandering through a trackless waste. Now, there's a literalness to that. There's probably a figurativeness as well. I know there's figurative. If you take Nebuchadnezzar, that's exactly what he did.
That's what, a lot of these you can go into the Old Testament and the New Testament and find things that match it real well. But it's not true, like you said, always. Okay, any other comments on 12 and 13? I've asked Janice to read chapter 14 for us. She's an old English teacher. I didn't mean that.
That don't sound right.
She's a retired English teacher. She has taught drama. She has taught Shakespeare. So she's going to read this to us as poetry. But I think chapter 14 is a very important chapter in the whole book. This is a tremendous lament. It's beautiful poetry. It's a melancholy lament about the shape that men are in life, about the way things are. And another thing before all that, Janice reads, Job will say, man has this trouble, and he's talking about himself. And then he'll say, I have this trouble, and he's talking about mankind in general. So he's kind of put himself in the position of mankind here, okay? So read 14 for us, Janice.
I thought I'd like to say the story, lament, is some of the finest poetry, no matter the culture, no matter the age. Just read Tennyson, for example,
or Cooper.
And this is ancient, more ancient than that. So it's a beautiful thing. Man born of woman is of good days and full of trouble. He springs up like a flower and withers away like a fleeting shadow. He does not endure. Do you fix your eye on such a one? Will you bring him before you for judgment? Who can bring what is pure from the impure? No one. Man's days are determined. You have decreed the number of his months and have set limits he cannot exceed. So look away from him and let him alone till he has put in his time like a hired man. At least there is hope for a tree. If it is cut down, it will sprout again, and its shoots will not fail. Its roots may grow old in the ground, and its stump die in soil. Yet, at the scent of water, it will bud and put forth shoots like a plant. But man dies and is laid low. He breathes last and is no more. As water disappears from the sea, or a riverbed becomes parched and dry, so man lies down and does not rise. Till the heavens are no more, men will not awake or be roused from their sleep. If only you would hide me in the grave and conceal me till your anger has passed. If only you would set me a time and then remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait for my renewal to come. You will call, and I will answer you. You will long for the creature your hands have made. Surely then you will count my steps, but not keep track of my sin. My offenses will be sealed up in a bag. You will cover over my sin. But as a mountain erodes and crumbles, and as a rock is moved from its place, as water wears away stones and torrents wash away the soil, so you destroy man's hope. You overpower him once for all, and he is gone. You change his countenance and send him away. If his sons are honored, he does not know it. If they are brought low, he does not see it. He feels with the pain of his own body, and mourns only for himself.
Okay. I find that amazing. Okay. You know, here is Job, 1,000 years before Jesus, no New Testament revelation about anything. He's suffering, and he basically says, you know, we're only here a short time, and life's full of trouble. Okay? That's a man born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. He springs up like a flower and withers away like a fleeting shadow. He does not endure. That's the condition of man in life. He starts to speculate about this tree, you know. He says, at least there's hope for a tree. Man ain't got any hope. He dies and he's dead. But a tree can kind of spring back to life, you know. And so he says, if only you would hide me in the grave. He's wishing that they would be, God would call him out after his anger's gone, call him from the grave, and have a relationship with him where his sins are not condemning him. To me, that's a perfect picture of the resurrection and heaven. You know, right here. A thousand years before Jesus came and taught about heaven. And you know, that's amazing to me that a man suffering, through suffering, could arrive at least a hopeful conclusion that there's got to be something beyond this life. You know, if a man dies, will he live again? If so, you'll call me and I'll answer it. You'll long for the creatures your hands have made. You'll surely count my steps, but not keep track of my sin. Be no sin, no tears in heaven. And that's what he's saying. If a man comes out of the grave. And that's just amazing to me. And I have to ask, did God reveal this to Job, or did he arrive at this conclusion because of his suffering? You know, is this something that he said, I'm suffering so bad I have no hope, and I gotta have hope. We gotta hope in something. So I don't have any hope in this life. Surely there's got to be something beyond this. Did he arrive by logic, or did God? Because Elihu, this strange fourth character here, he's going to appear later in the book, and he's going to say a lot of things about suffering that Bildad so far and Elihu don't even consider. But one of the things he said that I think is profound is he says, those who suffer, God speaks to in his suffering. And that's powerful. You know, that is a one real value of suffering, I think. So, you know, Job is I just love the book because it's so profound. Here's a man maybe a thousand years before Jesus, and he comes up with some brilliant observations and thoughts and hopes, you know. So,
I refer to verse 16 and 17. Both of those kind of touch me a little bit. Surely you will count my steps, but not keep track of my sin, which is what Christians are promised in a way.
Right. Yeah.
God will judge us, but yet our sins are covered. And then my offenses would be sealed up in a bag, and you will cover over my sin.
Yeah, he speculates, if there's life after death, this is what I'm hoping for, that God will call me out and I'll have a relationship where he doesn't keep track of my sins. But
if you're saying count my steps, does that mean keep up with me?
Yeah,
okay.
Count your sins. Verse 18 to the end of the chapter there, he falls back into hopelessness. And that's a real lament, a hopeless condition. So, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes. Any comments on 14? I'm going to stop there. Y'all want some more theology from Linus in the funny paper?
Yeah, go for it.
Lucy and Linus are standing in front of a window and it's pouring down rain outside. And Lucy says, I tell you, when it rains like this, it just scares me to death because I'm afraid it's just going to rain and it floods the world. And Linus says, it'll never happen. In Genesis 9, God promises us he'll never destroy the world with water again. And he gave us a rainbow for a sign. And Lucy says, that's a load off my mind. And Linus says, good theology has a way of doing that. I'll share another one with you next week. Linus is a real good theologian.